What's the takeaway for October 31st, 2017?
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks for being with us today as we reckon with three officials from the campaign of President Donald Trump facing criminal charges from Robert Mueller's investigation into possible connections between the campaign and Russia.
Former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort.
Paul Manafort and Rick Gates, Manafort's former business associate.
The charges were unsealed against Manafort and Gates.
Pleaded not guilty after being indicted today to charges that include
conspiracy and money laundering,
fraud, tax evasion,
conspiracy against the United States,
and failure to register as an agent of a foreign government.
Both are under house arrest tonight.
There is no evidence that Mr. Manafort or the Trump campaign colluded with the Russian government. This indictment is ridiculous.
Now, none of these charges, as far as we know, point directly toward collusion with Russia. But then there's George Papadopoulos, a young, little-known former foreign policy advisor to the Trump campaign.
George Papadopoulos, he's an oil and energy consultant, excellent guy.
Prosecutors say Papadopoulos was in contact with a professor with ties to the Kremlin as early as April 2016, and that Papadopoulos knew in the spring that the Russian government had, quote, dirt on Hillary Clinton in the form of thousands of her emails. It wasn't until late July of last year that those emails were released to the public by WikiLeaks. On July 27th of this year, the FBI arrested George Papadopoulos for lying about the professor. He pleaded guilty to that charge, and he's been cooperating with Robert Mueller's investigators ever since. We're going to get to the legal implications of that guilty plea, but first, who is George Papadopoulos?
I never heard of Papadopoulos. He never showed up at Trump Tower.
Now, I knew everybody in the Trump campaign. I never heard about Papadopoulos.
On Monday night, Mr. Trump's lawyer told CBS News that the president definitely doesn't have a clue who George Papadopoulos is.
White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders yesterday.
This individual was the member of a volunteer advisory council that met one time over the course of a year. And he was part of a list that was read out in the Washington Post. I'd hardly call that some sort of regular advisor, or as you want to, you know, push that he's like a senior member of the staff. He was not paid by the campaign. He was a volunteer on a council that met once.
That's the White House press secretary downplaying George Papadopoulos' role in the Trump campaign. And today, the president tweeted, "Few people knew the young, low-level volunteer named George, who's already been proven a liar." The president also said, "Check the Dems." Max Kuttner is here. Max is senior politics writer at Newsweek, where he leads coverage of the FBI, the Justice Department, and the Russia investigation. Max, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Well, what do we know about George Papadopoulos, his background, and just what was he doing for the Trump campaign?
The main thing to know about him, Todd, was just how young he was. He didn't have a lot of experience. When President Trump, as a candidate, first announced that he was on his national security and foreign policy team, that was kind of the narrative that was coming out about George Papadopoulos, just how young he was. He graduated from college in 2009. He had some experience at a think tank for several years. And then he finds himself on the Dr. Ben Carson campaign. When that campaign winds down, he goes over to the Trump campaign, and he stayed there, according to his LinkedIn page, until January. And then, as we learned just yesterday, it was in January that he first was asked to speak with FBI agents.
And we heard the White House press secretary there really downplaying Papadopoulos' role in the campaign, calling him a volunteer. Is that accurate?
You know, whether he was paid or not, we don't know, or I don't know. Maybe he was technically a volunteer, but that was certainly downplaying his role. There's this photo of him that has certainly resurfaced this week, showing him literally with a seat at the table with President Trump back when Trump was a candidate. So he was seated at the table. He was out representing himself as a member of the campaign, perhaps an official of the campaign, to these people who he thought had Kremlin connections. And he was certainly in touch with campaign leadership.
And do we know why the FBI got drawn to George Papadopoulos in the first place? They started talking to him back in January. Is it because of emails?
I believe that is correct, that when emails were turned over from the campaign, they did come across those. That's my understanding. They spoke with him on January 27, which was a week after inauguration. And as we learned yesterday, he gave false information, misrepresented things, and then it was several months later that he would be arrested.
And safe to say that when a young, very young George Papadopoulos started working for the Trump campaign and getting in contact with Russians, probably never envisioned himself being the subject of conversations like this one and thousands like them across America.
Right. I think he thought he was doing a great thing. He apparently met this professor, according to the documents released yesterday, who had said that he had Kremlin connections. He said he'd introduce Papadopoulos to Putin's niece, as Papadopoulos wrote in one of his emails. He was new to the campaign. I think he was thought that this would make him an asset and very valuable to the campaign. Obviously, that has come crashing down because he then lied to the FBI about all of this.
And if he was young and new to politics, he's now found himself at the center of a Washington scandal. That's a place that's been familiar to other young political people in Washington before.
Yes, he is at the center. I'm seeing a lot of legal analysts talking about how the charges to which he has pleaded guilty yesterday compared to those involving Manafort and Rick Gates, that if the Manafort case kind of doesn't mention Trump, it actually doesn't mention Trump at all. This one is all about the Trump campaign, this Papadopoulos case.
Well, let's talk about those charges, the implications of the guilty plea. We're going to get right to it. Max Cutner with Newsweek, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
George Papadopoulos is the first person to publicly plead guilty to a crime in the Russia investigation. It was all laid out in that 14-page statement of offense where Papadopoulos admits to lying to the FBI about when he was in contact with Russians or potential Russian agents while still working for the Trump campaign. Amy Sabrin is a retired partner from the law firm Skadden Arps, where she's represented many public officials and executives in DOJ investigations. Amy, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Nice to be here.
What does it mean that George Papadopoulos has pled guilty and is reportedly cooperating? What kind of information might investigators be looking for from him?
They will be looking for who he spoke to about what his Russian contacts told him, and in particular, the fact that was stated in the court papers that he was told that the Russians had dirt on Hillary Clinton and had thousands of her emails. Who in the Trump campaign knew about that? What instructions he might have been given in response, other than what's reflected in the bare-bones statements in the documents that were filed in court. They might have put a wire on him, as people say. That's speculation at this point. Any number of topics that he's cooperating on and has to continue to cooperate on until he is sentenced, which will not be probably until after the conclusion of this investigation.
That is speculation that George Papadopoulos could have worn a wire in the meanwhile, but is it crazy speculation? Is that a real-world scenario?
That's a real-world scenario, and as both his guilty plea and the Manafort indictment show, Mueller and his team are playing hardball, so yes, it's possible.
So it's fair to say then that this guilty plea in the big picture is really less about young, unknown George Papadopoulos and more about what he knew and who he talked to.
Yes. Exactly. And the greatest significance of his plea may be with regard to obstruction of justice allegations, because the question is, why did he lie at that interview? Did he talk to anybody before he was interviewed about what he was going to say and receive any instructions on how to respond? That would be obstruction of justice in that case. And did he report on his interview to anybody after the fact, which would all relate to obstruction of justice charges?
Well, let's talk about that timeline then and how it may fit with potential obstruction of justice or even collusion. Investigators first talked to Papadopoulos in January of this year. He was arrested back in July and didn't plead guilty until early October. That means he was probably talking to investigators for months, and it looked like nobody outside the investigative team knew about that. So what does that tell you about the potential timing of his initial lie, then his cooperation, and about Mueller's investigation?
Well, interestingly, his interview was on January 27th, 2017, shortly after Trump was sworn in as president. On January 24th, 2017, you'll remember Michael Flynn was interviewed by the FBI. On January 26th, Sally Yates, then acting attorney general, goes to the White House and informs White House counsel that Flynn was interviewed and that he had lied to Mike Pence about his contacts with Russians. Then the next day is when Papadopoulos is interviewed. That is also the day that President Trump called Comey at lunchtime, invited him to dinner, and then spoke to him at dinner about loyalty and whether he wanted to keep his job.
So does all that say then that Mueller may be using Papadopoulos as a window both into potential obstruction of justice charges, as you said, and we don't know about those yet, but also into the counterintelligence narrative, into possible collusion with Russian agents?
Yes, absolutely. The key allegation that he pled guilty to was lying about what his relationship was with the campaign at the time of a conversation when Russian operatives told him that they had dirt on Clinton and thousands of her emails, at a time, by the way, when that was not publicly known. It was before any of the emails began to be leaked. So, yes, obviously collusion is at the heart of this.
So, Amy, when we look at this week and how these indictments and George Papadopoulos's guilty plea were rolled out, is there a message here? Robert Mueller releases the plea agreement on the very same day as the 14-count indictments against Paul Manafort and Rick Gates. What's he saying by doing those things together?
Well, we can only speculate. And I just want to comment on the Manafort indictment. It's breathtaking in its own way. It doesn't touch on collusion directly, but it alleges that the Republican candidate for president of the United States chose a campaign manager who was laundering tens of millions of dollars he received for acting as an agent for a puppet government of Vladimir Putin, and that he did it while he was running Trump's campaign and that he lied about it to the FBI. What I speculate Mueller and his team were trying to send the message is, if you don't cooperate, you are going to get slammed with everything we can throw at you. And if you do cooperate, you will get a greatly reduced sentence and much leniency.
It seems to send the message to anyone watching, which is everyone, that we have someone who's cooperating, we have someone who's talking, don't get caught up in it.
Well, that's true, too, and it sort of puts them on notice that they have a way to test the accuracy of what any witness may be telling them, if they are a witness who was in communication with George Papadopoulos. The other thing I just want to add about the fact that he's a cooperating witness, this cooperating witness may not know that much. I just want to make clear that the statement of offense does not in its face provide direct evidence that anyone else from the campaign colluded with the Russians. There's nothing in that document that's inconsistent with the White House claim that Papadopoulos' role was insignificant and that he was only tangentially related to the campaign. The document significantly does not state that he specifically made campaign officials aware that his Russian contacts said they had dirt and that they had Clinton-related emails. Now, this could be because the special counsel didn't want to reveal the evidence he has, or it could be because he does not have that evidence, but the document is silent on that point. And then the document also provides some exculpatory evidence that campaign officials wanted to communicate to Papadopoulos that there would be no meetings with the Russians, and they pushed back on that.
And it's certainly fair to say that George Papadopoulos is not the last person that Robert Mueller and his prosecutors will be talking to about potential collusion or potential obstruction of justice. Amy Sabrin, retired partner at Skadden Arps, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for being with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. The indictment against Paul Manafort and Rick Gates spanned nearly 10 years of political consulting work in Ukraine on behalf of the pro-Russian government there, the Party of Regions, and the opposition bloc. Now, Manafort and Gates both entered not guilty pleas on Monday. The White House said again that the charges have nothing to do with the President of the United States. Here's Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort in July 2016 with Nora O'Donnell on CBS.
So to be clear, Mr. Trump has no financial relationships with any Russian oligarchs.
That's what he said. That's what I said. That's obviously what our position is.
Ann Applebaum is a Pulitzer Prize winning historian, a columnist for The Washington Post, and an expert on politics in Eastern Europe. Her most recent book is Red Famine, Stalin's War on Ukraine, which we talked about here on the show a couple of weeks ago. Ann, it's good to have you back.
Thank you.
And you've said that in 2016, when you saw some of President Trump's strategies and tactics in the campaign, running on anti-elite rhetoric, stoking ethnic divisions, complaining that the election was rigged against him, that it all looked familiar to you.
Absolutely. Almost as soon as Trump appointed Manafort, I started watching for Ukrainian-style tactics, meaning the tactics that Manafort had used in Ukraine to promote a pro-Russian candidate who was also profoundly corrupt, as it turned out, and who also eventually sought to undermine the Constitution. These included the constant claim that his opponents were corrupt, the constant talk of rigged elections, focusing on particular ethnic groups and setting them against other ethnic groups. These were all absolutely Russian-style tactics that Manafort has used before and that we saw absolutely in our election campaign as well.
Well, how do Ukrainians view Manafort and his team and the history of their work in their country for so long?
So when Manafort was appointed to the Trump campaign, there was real consternation in Ukraine because people knew exactly who he was. He'd been there for many years. He was very closely identified with a disastrous president who wound up fleeing the country, so much so that Ukrainians actually began digging for evidence that Manafort had defied the law in Ukraine. And last summer, they produced this proof that he'd been paid off the books by one of the Ukrainian political parties, something like $12 million in cash. And that may have been one of the early clues that the FBI used to start tracing what had happened to Manafort's money. I know that when the indictment came out yesterday, there was widespread interest and rejoicing in Ukraine, certainly among the people who wanted to see him and his corrupt party defeated. You know, lots of people are saying, "We told you so."
Well, claims of "we told you so" coming from Ukraine. Ann Applebaum, Manafort's history in Ukraine, his political operations is one thing. But you've been writing about the combination of that and what's in the indictment that you mentioned, the charges themselves, the use of shell companies, offshore banks, the alleged lavish spending, the alleged money laundering, and that all of that in Manafort's behavior, quite outside his 9-to-5, sounds familiar too.
So Paul Manafort is evidence of something that's been disturbing me for a long time, which is an increasing convergence between a part of the American, actually really Western, political and business elite and the post-Soviet political and business elite. These are people who have no qualms about hiding their money in offshore accounts, moving it around the world secretly, spending it lavishly, treating the states that they come from cynically. This is a world that essentially huge amounts of loose money coming out of Russia and other post-Soviet countries over the last 10 years have contributed to the growth and expansion of this whole secret world of hidden money. And the West has absolutely facilitated it, and a lot of Western businessmen and politicians have taken advantage of it.
So to be clear, Ann Applebaum, what you're suggesting there is a kind of emulation among these political operatives, certainly Manafort, possibly others, of a Russian way of doing business and politics and mixing business with politics.
Well, this is what Trump himself does. And Trump very much lives like a Russian oligarch, and he mixes with Russian oligarchs. And this is the world that he admires. Putin is somebody he emulates. He's spoken of him reverently in the past. And this is because Putin, of course, is the ultimate Russian oligarch. He's the one who is thought to have the most money and to have the most power and to have managed to turn money into power and vice versa better than anybody else has done. And he never has really hidden his feelings that this is the world to which he aspires. And of course, he's not alone. Manafort has been close to him for many years. He would certainly have known that Manafort had these kinds of contacts in Russia and in the pro-Russian parts of the Ukrainian establishment, because that's mostly what Manafort has been doing for the last decade.
And let's talk about timing for a moment. We got a call from Michigan about the timing of Manafort's actions that are alleged in the indictments that he's pled not guilty to and how it's connected potentially to the White House.
Hi, this is Andrew in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Trump said on Twitter that if Manafort may have done something, it was prior to him being involved in the campaign. How much do his charges hinge on the timing?
So, Anne, the question there, you know, the president says, sorry, all of this took place long before the Trump campaign, has nothing to do with me and nothing to do with collusion.
So Trump hired Manafort at a moment when Manafort was profoundly enmeshed in Russian business, and Trump could not have not known that. And what the charges do is they establish that this was the case. But I also think it's incorrect that they stop before the campaign. We know there's evidence that Manafort was in touch with Russian oligarchs, was looking to sell influence even up to the spring of 2016. So the idea that he was somehow separate from this and that he joined the campaign while he had no connection to Russia is absurd.
You know, Anne, we're going to let you go, but everything you're saying about Paul Manafort, his education in Eastern Europe, Ukrainian-style tactics, Russian-style tactics, he's been charged now, but is he the only person, is he the only American political operative who's learned how to do these things? I mean, we have to remember these tactics helped win an American election, and I would think that others might want to use them in the future.
No, absolutely. There are many people who have studied the same thing. Actually, Manafort had quite a lot of help in Ukraine. He at one point brought a couple of dozen American consultants over to help him remake Yanukovych's image, to help him learn how to talk on TV, to help him pick out the right suits. These are widely known tactics. And I don't want to suggest, by the way, that they are, you know, somehow unique to Russia or only Russia could have done it. I mean, certainly the use of social media, the use of this very divisive, targeted messaging, that's something anybody is going to be able to do. And it's important that we pay attention to how these kinds of elections are run, and that we look for antidotes that go beyond this particular election and these particular people.
Anne Applebaum, author of Red Famine, Stalin's War on Ukraine, and columnist for The Washington Post. Anne, it's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Candidates, political operatives, and analysts are searching for signs about what voters are going to do in 2018. And they're watching a couple of off-year governor's races that are coming up next week to find out where voters might be headed next year. There's one race in New Jersey we're going to talk about in just a few minutes. The other is in Virginia, where things have gotten ugly.
MS-13 is a menace. Yet Ralph Northam voted in favor of sanctuary cities that let dangerous illegal immigrants back on the street.
Ed Gillespie's false attacks. Independent Press says they're false, fear-mongering, absurd.
All that spooky, foreboding music, it's enough to scare you on Halloween. Those are excerpts from campaign ads from each of the candidates here. Voters in Virginia will choose between Republican Ed Gillespie, who's run for Senate before, worked in the Bush White House, and Democrat Ralph Northam, the current lieutenant governor of Virginia. Today, most polls have Gillespie behind Northam, but it's a tight and closely watched race. Michael Pope is with Virginia Public Radio, and he joins me now. Michael, welcome.
It's great to be here.
Well, we heard the ads and we heard the spooky music. Give us a snapshot of the race so far. What are the themes?
And what you were hearing actually in those ads has to do with a bill that went before the General Assembly earlier this year on sanctuary cities. Republicans had a bill to essentially go after cities that refused to comply with federal immigration law. And the kicker to this is Virginia has no sanctuary cities. Nevertheless, the Republicans wanted to move forward with this bill. So in the state Senate, they actually engineered a vote where some Republicans that actually wanted to pass this law voted against it to create a tie in the state Senate. Well, who breaks the tie in the state Senate? The lieutenant governor. So Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam actually broke the tie and voted against this bill. Then they brought it up again, and the Republicans actually passed it. So it went to the governor, Terry McAuliffe, who's a Democrat who vetoed the bill. Nevertheless, the Republicans now have this talking point that Ralph Northam voted to break the tie in the state Senate, voting against this bill to crack down on sanctuary cities that even Gillespie admits don't exist in Virginia.
Michael, let's talk about the ads in this race. There have been charges of race baiting in this campaign. You've mentioned that it's gotten ugly. Ed Gillespie running ads tying Ralph Northam to MS-13 gangs, pledging to protect Confederate monuments. Northam running ads using imageries of pickup trucks with Confederate flags on them, chasing down Latinos. It's gotten weird and ugly.
It has, you know, and it's a little counterintuitive because in Gillespie's background, back when he, you know, this is a former chairman of the Republican National Committee, in his past, he has actually tried to argue to the Republican Party that they should do outreach to immigrants, to Latinos. And Northam actually was at one time pursued by the Republican Party to switch parties and become a Republican. So both of them now are moving in the opposite direction of that.
Meanwhile, President Trump's approval rating in Virginia, I think, is around 34%. That has to be an enormous drag on his fellow Republican Ed Gillespie. How important is it for Democrats to win this race in a year when it looks like Republicans are going to suffer in 2018?
Gillespie, as you point out, has to sort of navigate the politics of Trump in the age of Trump. His primary opponent was someone who was actually from the Trump wing of the party, someone who actually served at one time as the chair of the Trump campaign in Virginia. who shares many of these Trump positions on immigration, the Confederate flag. So Gillespie has tried to walk this line where, you know, he wants those Trump voters, but Trump has not actually campaigned for him in Virginia. In fact, when asked directly if he wanted Trump to campaign for him in Virginia, he didn't answer the question. So Trump certainly serves as the backdrop to this entire campaign. And will, you know, the results of this election will be viewed as, you know, a rejection of Trump or a support of Trump in some way.
Everyone looking for the signs coming from Virginia. Can a Republican win with the president at 34%? We're going to find out. And then, of course, the analysts will tell us what all of this means for 2018. Michael Pope with Virginia Public Radio. Thanks.
Thank you.
New Jersey is in the throes of a governor's race. Voters will choose between Republican Lieutenant Governor Kim Guadagno and Democrat Phil Murphy. Nancy Solomon is managing editor for New Jersey Public Radio and WNYC. She's here with me. She's got the latest on the race that, like Virginia's, is attracting all of that attention from well beyond state borders because it's an off year and everybody's looking at 2018. Nancy, welcome.
Hi, Todd.
Well, what are the main themes in this New Jersey race?
You know, we expected Trump to be a major theme, but I would say that that for the entirety of the campaign, really, Chris Christie and the former Democratic Governor John Corzine have loomed much larger than Trump.
What are New Jersey voters concerned about then, if they're not as concerned about the career of Chris Christie and the approval ratings of the president?
Well, they are concerned about Chris Christie, and I think they don't want a repeat. And, you know, his approval ratings are even worse than Donald Trump's. So you have that. Property taxes is always, it's a perennial issue in New Jersey, and the Republican candidate, Kim Guadagno, has tried to push that a lot. Phil Murphy, you know, ran into some trouble with Democrats over the perception that he was another John Corzine, a guy who worked for Goldman Sachs, made a lot of money, was throwing his own money into the race. But, you know, he's done a good job of showing people that he's about more than just the fact that he had millions to spend on his campaign. And he really convinced the progressive wing of the Democratic Party to fall in line behind him. Right now, he's ahead in the polls in double digits. And what it all comes down to now in the last week is going to be turnout.
Nancy, has this campaign managed to steer clear of so much of what I'll call the ugliness that has marked a lot of the other campaigns? We just talked about Virginia, where there are ethnically charges, commercials that are extremely racially charged, race baiting in some cases. Has New Jersey managed to avoid this kind of thing?
No, not at all. I think what we saw was Kim Guadagno, as she was unable to make up the gap in the polls, you know, each successive poll that came out, she just wasn't gaining ground. She pivoted from in the opposite direction of what you usually see of the right turn during the primary to the base and then the pivot back to the center for the general. She did the opposite. She played the moderate during the primary and then now in the last few weeks has made this hard right pivot. She put out an ad that's been compared to the Willie Horton ad against Mike Dukakis from when was that? The 90s? The 80s?
1988.
Thank you. So it was an ad that took Phil Murphy's words on camera out of context and made it sound like he was saying that he would provide sanctuary to immigrants, even if they are murderers or rapists. And it was a very offensive ad to many people in New Jersey. And it doesn't appear to be helping her. I think, you know, this is her Hail Mary to see if there's really historic low voter turnout in this race. You know, would the Republican base that she's now speaking to, you know, help her?
Guadagno may want low turnout. You know, the governor's position in New Jersey is not ceremonial. It's a very powerful governorship under that state's constitution. But Nancy, do voters there, if Guadagno is counting on low turnout, if Phil Murphy, pardon me, is counting on high turnout, do voters in New Jersey have the sense of what I mentioned before, that everyone is watching this off-year election for the signs of where 2018 is headed and that part of their vote is a national vote, even though they're voting for governor?
I think that is true for one segment of the Democratic Party. I mean, there is a lively Trump resistance movement in New Jersey. I've been covering this movement since its inception after the election. And so you have a bunch of people who have never been politically active, who have gotten involved. They're more focused on the Republican congressmen in the district, Rodney Frelinghuysen, Leonard Lance, MacArthur, et cetera. But now they've shifted towards supporting Murphy and they want to turn out. But I would say that that's still just a slice of New Jersey.
Off-year governor's election in New Jersey. The outsiders are watching. Nancy Solomon, managing editor for New Jersey Public Radio and WNYC. Thanks, Nancy.
Thanks, Todd.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you. Lying to the FBI is a crime. We already talked about that with George Papadopoulos and how he learned that. But what about lying to a jury under oath when the identity of a murderer is at stake? On July 11th, 2001, Larrick Sherman was shot to death outside the Taft Homes housing project in Peoria, Illinois. A man named Payson Long was arrested and charged with first-degree murder. He's had two trials. He's been convicted both times under conditions that Andrew Cohen says are constitutionally questionable.
The first time he was accused and charged of murder and convicted, the courts of Illinois threw out the case because of prosecutorial misconduct. The second time, evidently, the conviction is going to stick, even though there's no physical evidence linking him to a murder. There's no scientific evidence linking him to a murder. There's no confession. The only real reason he's in jail is because of the testimony of two people whose stories were particularly shaky, one of whom actually lied on the witness stand during the second trial and was not corrected in that lie by prosecutors.
Now, lying under oath is a crime, but who's responsible for pointing it out during a trial? That's the topic of this week's Case in Point from the Marshall Project. And Andrew Cohen says that while lying in court is common, prosecutors don't always step up if they know a lie might weaken their case.
Lying in trial happens. It happens more than we would care to admit. The system is set up to conceive of the possibility that witnesses are going to come into court and make statements that they want to make that are in their interest but not the truth. Theoretically, a prosecutor is supposed to stand up and say, wait a minute, you are now saying X, you said Y before, which is it? Or if there is reason to believe that an actual lie has taken place, to actually tell the jury before deliberations. The whole point of the trial is to give the jury the best information available. When that moment came in this trial, in Brooklyn Irby in the second trial of Payson Long refused to tell the truth, the prosecutor not only didn't say anything at the time to jurors, but gave the impression during closing arguments that she was not lying at all. To me, that's a constitutional violation and a prosecutorial violation that should give the defendant here some relief.
Why didn't Payson Long's defense attorneys argue that strongly and go to the judge and say, wait a second, this is a lie and the prosecutor knows it?
Well, they did. They didn't mention the prosecutor, but during the second trial, when this Brooklyn Irby incriminated Long, even though she had recanted her incrimination earlier, the defense stood up and they brought in an investigator, someone who was on the prosecution side, to say to jurors, yeah, it's true, she's not telling you today what she said before. But it's one thing for a defense attorney or a defense witness to make that statement, right, to a jury. It's another thing for the prosecutor to basically say that about his or her own witness. And in this case, the prosecutor, a woman, refused to essentially call out her own witness and clear the record in the case, and then compounded the effort during closing arguments by essentially endorsing the idea that the incriminating testimony was true when we know it wasn't. So this has been the subject of a recent ruling, the 7th U.S. Circuit Court, the federal appeals court that handles cases out of Illinois. And to me, it seems like this is a perfect case to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, because the court there, the justices in Washington, have been particularly interested lately in witnesses and trials and this sort of thing.
So, Andrew, one thing that you point out, which I think is intuitive to all of us, is that lying in court is not new. It happens all the time. There have been cases that we've heard of where somebody years after the fact comes forward and says, I can't take it anymore, I lied, and maybe there's a new trial or maybe somebody is exonerated based on that. This case is a little different because the lie and the knowledge of the lie happened within the same trial before the jury was even sent back for deliberations.
Yeah, that's right. Anybody could have cured it. The defense tried, right, with their witness, but prosecutors were silent. And there is a string of cases from the U.S. Supreme Court that says prosecutors have an affirmative obligation to correct a government witness when the witness has made a false statement. That didn't happen. And then the appellate court, the federal appeals court, essentially excused the prosecutor. You know, what's also missing from this equation is the judge. The judge knew that this witness had said something completely different in the second trial than what she had testified to the first time around. And the judge was silent about it. You would think at some point somebody would have chimed in before the deliberations began to say, listen, we want to clarify things for you. And to me, it speaks to the imbalance that takes place in a criminal trial. Prosecutors, I think, get far more of the benefit of the doubt than the defense, even though the law says that it's the defendants that are supposed to get the benefit of reasonable doubt.
Well, what have the prosecutors in this case said about their own conduct and whether they acted appropriately when Brooklyn Irby's testimony was known to not be true?
Yeah, well, they've defended themselves. They've said, look, it came out anyway. The fact that there were questions about the accuracy of this testimony were raised by the defense in a timely fashion. There was a witness, a law enforcement official who came to the stand and said, yep, Brooklyn Irby has this problem in this case, and that was enough. That was enough to cure whatever failings the prosecutors had made at trial in doing it themselves. My point is that for a jury in a criminal case involving a murder, for the prosecutor to say, look, this person is not really leveling with you, has far more import and impact than it would have coming from the defense. And I think maybe the conviction is proof of that. So we're waiting to see if this case goes, or at least is asked to go, to the U.S. Supreme Court. I tried to get in touch with the defendant's attorneys. They have no comment. But it seems to me, like I said before, this is a classic case that could go to the justices, who may want to clarify exactly what the duties are when the government's own witness comes to the stand and doesn't tell the truth.
A case of lying in criminal court, and whether prosecutors have a duty to notify a jury when they know that one of their witnesses is lying. Payson Long is in prison in Illinois waiting to find out the answer. And Andrew Cohen is bringing us up to date for the Marshall Project and Case in Point. Andrew, a pleasure as always.
My pleasure, too.
Hey, we always want to hear from you. Want to get in touch? 8778-MY-TAKE is the number. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. And you can get to me, too, on Twitter. I'm at Todd Zwillick. That's Zwillick with the CH.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples stores or staples.com/print-and-marketing. Staples, it's pro time. And LegalZoom.com, providing legal answers to the day-to-day questions of small business owners through its network of independent attorneys, available nationwide. More information at LegalZoom.com/takeaway. The Takeaway will be right back. Want to bring us with you on the go? Subscribe to The Takeaway as a podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Todd Zwillick, welcome back to The Takeaway. Leanne Womack made her debut on the country music scene in the late 1990s with commercial hits like I Hope You Dance. But she never really felt comfortable being a crossover artist, singing pop country ballads designed to sell.
I had to leave my life in Dallas. That town will always be you.
Now, more than two decades later, Leanne Womack is back, and she's not trying to generate pop hits anymore. Instead, she's going back to the more traditional country roots of her Texas upbringing, and on the road, she says her fans are pretty receptive to that old sound.
There's not a lot of real traditional country music out there these days, and so it's fun to connect with those people, and yeah, I mean, I guess I'll be touring forever.
The Lonely, the Lonesome, and the Gone is Leanne Womack's new album, out last Friday. Leanne stopped by to talk about the journey of her career, about the new record, and yes, about being on tour forever.
If I'm a crossover artist, I like to think of being a crossover artist in the same way Willie Nelson is. You know exactly who he is and what he does, you know, but he appeals to all audiences, and I'd love to have a career like that.
So when you made this hit, I Hope You Dance, back in 2000...
I hope you never
Was it with the intention of reaching that wider audience? Was that your aim?
Well, it was my aim from the beginning of my career. And the first song I ever put out was a song called Never Again Again.
Never again, again. Once more I'll let you back in. I know how the story ends.
Which was straight up real hardcore traditional country song. And so I'm from Texas, and Texans have a way of not so much categorizing things, putting things in boxes, you know, and so I just wanted to make music and make good music.
And so on your new album, The Lonely, The Lonesome, and The Gone, it seems like you're getting more traditional. You have one track on there called All the Trouble, which I liked a lot. Let's listen.
The deck is stacked against you. Life's a losing hand. Even when you think you're up, you're right back down again. Either way you play it, the house is gonna win.
Well, that sounds almost like a spiritual Leanne Womack. What's that sound? Is that East Texas where you're from?
It is. I mean, it's a big melting pot there, you know, and a lot of different kinds of music. But I grew up in church and listening to gospel and spiritual music. And so you go out and listen to music on Saturday night, and you go to church on Sunday, and there's more music. And it's just how I grew up.
Are you getting simpler now on this new album? Simpler than maybe your career in the early 2000s?
I don't know if I would say simpler, but I would say I'm in a position now to be more myself. And I signed, you know, a record deal contract that said I would make commercial music for that format. And I wanted to do that, and I wanted to make everybody happy, you know, at the record label and on the whole team. But I had this passion about traditional music and really roots music and the kind of stuff I grew up on. And I just really wanted to make myself happy and make them happy as well. And so I was always on that, riding that line, you know. And so I was always felt like I was trying to fit myself, you know, like a square peg into a round hole. Mm. But I looked forward to the day that I could make the kind of records I'm making now.
So does that mean, I mean, where we started when I asked you about that old label they used to slap on you, crossover artist, does that mean that that old label maybe was commercially successful, wasn't really you as an artist, and you're getting closer to it now?
I wouldn't say it wasn't me. I would say it was just so hard. Every day I would have to get up, every single, every record, get up and push that rock back up the hill, you know? And so I was working with people like Buddy and Julie Miller or Ricky Skaggs or people like that, you know, who were real roots and everything, and recording songs with them or recording their songs, things like that, and trying to get that to work in the commercial world. And I was having to fight to get it done constantly, day after day, you know. And so now I just don't have that fight. I'm in a position now just to do it, and people go, yeah, man, we love this. We know exactly what to do with this.
All right, well, let's listen to a little bit more of Leanne Womack without the fight. Here's the title track from the new album, The Lonely, The Lonesome, and The Gone.
And the old heartache is like an old Hank Williams song. Is the lonely, the lonesome, and gone?
No, Leanne Womack, you're right. I don't hear any fight there at all. You sound completely at peace.
Well, I love it. I love country music. I love real instruments and songs that tell stories and things like that.
Leanne Womack, every artist who comes through here lately gets asked about politics by me. I'll bet you, as a country singer in East Texas, have sung one or two national anthems in your day, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
You sung for the Dallas Cowboys?
I have, yeah.
So what's your take on the recent protests in the NFL with the national anthem? You've seen those protests as well. What do you think about?
I think we are very fortunate to live in a place where you can do that, and you can have different sides, and you can speak your mind, and I'm very, very thankful for that. Very grateful to be in a place where we can do that.
Would you be okay with it if you were singing at a Cowboys game and players took a knee while you sang?
Oh, sure. I mean, if they feel the need to express, you know, how they're feeling, then of course. People have fought and died for our right to do that.
Have you ever been tempted as an artist to put more politics or social issues in your music?
I think because of the way I grew up and the kinds of songs that I grew up listening to. I mean, listen, I'm a George Jones freak from the time I was a 5-year-old little girl.
He said, I'll love you till I die. She told him, you'll forget in time.
You know, my dad worked at the country radio station. He played Ray Price and George Jones and Merle Haggard and Buck Owens and all, you know. And so I am just obsessed with country music, and so much of the music that I listened to dealt with matters of the heart.
He kept her picture on his wall. Went half crazy now and then.
And so that's a part of my fabric. And like we said earlier, spiritual things and things like that. So, you know, that's what really moves me musically.
Well, your daughter, Aubrey Sellers, is a rising star. People might have heard of her as well. She calls her country, she calls it garage country, I think. But she's made some waves for calling out female stereotypes in pop culture, some politics in her music, to be sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, Aubrey's a lot smarter than me. And I'm proud of her. You know, it's difficult. It's difficult for anybody in this business this day and age, but for women especially. And I think she's doing a really good job at that. And I thank you for pointing that out.
The new album is The Lonely, The Lonesome, and The Gone from country music star Leanne Womack. It's been a pleasure having you.
It's been a pleasure being here, and thank you so much.
Morning cup of coffee, not a single word.
Well, happy Halloween, everybody, as we let you go. We've been asking you on our Facebook page for your best Halloween costumes ever. Nicole posted a picture of her family dressed up as Chunk and Sloth from The Goonies with their baby as a Baby Ruth bar. It's pretty cute. You should check it out. In the meantime, have a great Halloween. Have a safe trick-or-treat tonight. Watch out for the crazy lady on the corner. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
For asking, are you belong in Hollywood? 5 o'clock martinis, watch the sun go down.
PRI, Public Radio International.